There was one rookie mistake that I see over and over and over again. It's people think it's all about the deal and, you know, say, well, I've got a great deal. I've got a great deal. Well, you know what? It's never about the deal.
Welcome to the Rental Property Owner and Real Estate Investor Podcast, brought to you by the Rental Property Owner Association, providing benefits and services to real estate investors and rental property owners for over 48 years. With your host, Brian Hamrick from Hamrick Investment Group.
Hello and welcome to episode 70. As a syndicator in large apartment investments, I've certainly spent a lot of time and effort raising money from private investors. And I just read a book that I wish I'd had back when I started out. It's called Magnetic Capital, How to Raise All the Money You Need for Any Worthy Venture. And it teaches the fundamental methods that the top money managers in the world use to raise money every day. The author, Victor Menashe, is here with me today, and he's going to share the secrets that he's learned about raising other people's money. Victor, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
So I read your book. I really enjoyed it. There's so much great information in there. In your acknowledgments to the book, you mentioned your mother, who taught you about money and managing investments at an early age. And when you were 18, she passed away. And the investment holding company that she started became your responsibility. Can you talk about that difficult time and the huge learning experience that came from it?
Well, it was obviously very difficult and also a blessing at the same time. Funny how in life sometimes great things come out of adversity, and this was one of them. Fortunately, this was an investment holding company that my mother had started in the mid-1970s. My uncle owned a seat on the New York Stock Exchange, so he was one of the 1,000 members of the exchange. So it kind of grew up a little bit in that world, with exposure to the world of stocks and bonds. I remember seeing my uncle, trading overnight shares in Asia. You know, he'd be up in the middle of the night trading shares. And so I got an exposure to that at a very early age. And my mother taught me about money, the concept of compound interest and how to use rates of return to multiply your money. So that was really a very early schooling. Now, fortunately, when my mom passed away from 1982 to 1987, we had a fantastic bull market for 5 years, so it was difficult to make mistakes. And by 1987, when the crash happened in October of 87, we were reasonably well positioned, and it didn't hurt us that badly. You know, it hurt the top line balance sheet maybe by 10 or 15%, but we had managed to weather that reasonably well. And the key was we had very good advisors surrounding me, the same advisors that had advised her, and so they became, you know, I inherited her team overnight.
What were some of the decisions that you had to make during that time?
Well, the way we set it up at that point, my sister and I were the capital beneficiaries of her estate, and my father was to be the income beneficiary. So it essentially provided for his lifestyle for the rest of his years, and my sister and I did not touch the capital, but I was essentially the steward of that capital for our own benefit, as well as for protecting the income stream for him for the rest of his days. So that's really what guided it. And so we put together a balanced portfolio strategy that, you know, gave a balance between growth and income. And certainly if I was to do it again today, knowing what I know today, and the market conditions, of course, today are very different than they were in the mid-1980s, but I would certainly do it differently, because like anything in life, the more you know, the richer you are for it. And I was just very lucky that during that first five-year period, it was hard to make mistakes.
Yeah. And were you primarily investing the money in the stock market, or was there any sort of real estate component to that?
At that time, it was almost exclusively in the stock market. And knowing what I know today, well, today, in fact, I have almost nothing in the stock market. And, you know, one of the reasons for that, you know, once I, you know, went into my technology career and eventually became an officer of a U.S. public company, I witnessed the CEO of our company lying to the shareholders on the analyst calls. And I was thinking, oh, my goodness, those poor investors. And, you know, it really woke me up to the possibility that that might not be the only executive suite in the country where that was happening, and really determined that the small investor has little to no control over their investments in the public markets. And so it was at that point that I made the decision to exit the public markets and move into investment classes where I had a much stronger element of control. And certainly as a real estate developer today, I feel very much like I have that element of control.
This podcast is geared toward the real estate investor. And one of the things we talk about is raising money from other people, raising private money, using other people's money to do deals. And I'd like to kind of go down that line and start with the person or the investor that we might be trying to raise money from. And you talk in your book about what they care about and what they might be looking for when they decide where to invest or lend their money. Can you share that with us?
Absolutely. And maybe the place to start is with the psychology of raising money from the point of view of the entrepreneur looking to raise money. You know, oftentimes when I talk with new syndicators, folks that are new at raising money, the first statement I hear is, well, I'm uncomfortable asking for money. So that's why they're reluctant to get into that game. And I say, great, then don't ask for money. Because in fact, I don't ask for money. I take a completely different posture. I'm very secure in the projects that we're doing. I know they're good deals. I know our team is strong. We've got a track record. So I'm never desperate for capital. But what I do is I offer potential investors the opportunity to collaborate on a project. And that's a very different posture. It's never asking for money. And you know, money has to fit. It's kind of like a pair of shoes. You know, you might go to the shoe store and you see the most lovely pair of shoes and you say, oh gosh, it's my lucky day, they're on sale. But if they don't fit, you're not a buyer. It doesn't matter how lovely they are or how deeply discounted they are. If they don't fit, you're not a buyer. And it's exactly the same with investing. Investors have an agenda for their money. They have a set of goals that they're looking to meet. And if the goals for the money and the goals for the project don't align, it's not going to work. Don't take the money. Don't try and force it. It's got to be that natural fit. So if you go into it with that mindset, raising money is much, much easier. It takes an awful lot of the pressure off, in fact.
Can you give us an example? Like, say, let's say I was an investor that you were wanting to raise money from. What might you say to me that would connect with me on that psychological level?
Well, the first thing I would do is I'd try and understand what your goals are. So, for example, you might come to me and say, well, Victor, I'm looking to put my money to work only for relatively short time periods. I'm looking for, you know, I don't know, maybe 15% return, whatever the number is, but I want to be recycling my money into a new project every 6 months. So if that's the case, I'm not going to put you into a long-term hold. It doesn't make any sense. The only thing that would fit for that would be potentially bridge financing or maybe a short-term flip opportunity. Those would be the only things that would fit for someone with those criteria. On the other hand, if I have someone else who's, in fact, I have an investor whose perspective is, if my money's sitting on the sidelines, it's earning zero. So I want my money to work all the time. I'm looking for 5-year investments. And for that investor, a long-term hold is going to be much more appropriate. Giving him a 6-month flip doesn't make any sense. When you look at raising money, what I uncovered after doing this for a number of years, I started this actually in the high-tech industry, raising money for startup companies and for corporate buyouts. I've done 5 different mergers and acquisitions in my career. And what I discovered is that there were 5 basic principles to raising money. And when all of those principles are met, raising money is relatively easy. And if one of those principles, one or more, are missing, it gets extraordinarily difficult. So maybe the place to start would be to talk about those principles, because then I think it'll make it much easier for the listener to understand how they might present one of their own projects.
Okay.
If they have that, you know, a particular project in mind. So,
yeah, and you mentioned the 5 fundamental elements to raising money in your book. So let's discuss those now. What are those 5 fundamental elements?
Sure. So number 1 is relationship. If you're looking to raise hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars from an individual who has, you know, poured their life savings or maybe a business sale, if they've developed a nest egg, they're probably not going to do that with somebody they don't have a good relationship with. So it really starts with relationship. And when I say relationship, I don't mean networking or any of those other utilitarian terms. I'm talking genuine relationship, and it really starts at that level. This is not a process of hunting. This is a process of farming, and relationships are built over time. If you think about relationships and the natural progression that they follow, they take time to develop. And, you know, if you think about just romantic relationships, they start out, you know, maybe a man and a woman, they meet, they go out for coffee, they maybe then go for dinner, then a movie, and then years down the road, they may, you know, start a family. But if you skip even a couple of steps in that process, you go from a natural progression to creepy in a heartbeat. And how often do we witness people going to creepy in business? Because they're skipping steps in that relationship building. And my advice is, don't skip steps because you're going to creepy. And the women in the audience will relate to this instantly. So it really focuses on genuine relationship. And the most important thing is the maintenance and development of that relationship. It's never the deal. And if you maintain that perspective, then potential funding partners are going to be much more open to investing with you, not just for one deal, but on a sustained basis over a long period of time.
Where might one go to find people to develop these relationships with?
People with a lot of money generally are quite generous. Some people think they're greedy. It's actually the opposite. So you often find them involved in philanthropy. You don't have to have $1 billion to go to a charity event. You can, you know, have a particular cause in common with someone who has a lot of wealth. And that's perfectly fine. And use that as a basis to which, as a basis to develop a relationship. That would be, I think, a great place to start.
So of the five fundamental elements, relationship is the first one. What is the next one?
The next one is trust. And trust is a complex psychological contract. It's not just, is this an honest person? It's a whole series of questions like, can I trust you to put together a good plan? Can I trust you to execute the plan? Can I trust you to hire the right people? Can I trust you to communicate in an open and transparent way? Can I trust you to communicate if there's a problem? Can I trust you with my money? And on and on and on. And if any one of those is missing, it actually doesn't work. So it really is understanding at a much deeper level how trust is built and conversely how trust can be shattered in a heartbeat. Trust is built slowly over time, meeting even small commitments, and it's foundational to the relationship. You might have a good friendship with somebody, but they may not trust you. So trust is key.
Yeah, so trust is a fundamental element. And in your book, you talk about how it's really kind of a two-way street because there are some predatory lenders and investors out there that you've run across.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Can you tell us, give us an example or tell us a story about, you know, how sometimes when you're raising money, you have to be careful about where you're getting it from?
I've never run into this directly myself because I can sort of smell them from a mile away. But I know several of them. In fact, I know a few hard money lenders from the West Coast. One guy I'm thinking of in particular, I obviously won't say his name, but here's somebody who likes to set people up for failure, and he makes way more money by getting the points up front on a loan, securing the property at 70% loan to value, and then, you know, taking you out 6 months later because you weren't able to sell the property in time and you run out of cash. So they have various techniques that they use. They charge a lot of points up front. They give you a short term for the loan with very few opportunities for extension, so that you default by hitting up against the term of the loan, and then you have no mechanism to refinance. Obviously have to ask yourself the question, what can go wrong in this project? If it takes an extra 3 months, if it takes an extra 6 months, am I still going to be okay? And oftentimes predatory lenders do set you up for failure. Just watch out for them and stay away.
So relationships, trust, those are the first two of the fundamental elements to raising money. What comes next?
Next is results. What's your track record? Show me that you have the ability on a sustained basis to multiply money. That's what people are looking for, is that track record. Now, this is the real world. Bad things do happen. Sometimes people make mistakes. You know, anyone who's been in this business long enough will have run into difficulty at some point in time. Be open, be honest about it, but also demonstrate that you have a track record. And it's not just your track record personally. We're talking about the track record of your team. Now, often I hear the question from rookie investors, well, how am I going to raise any money if I don't have a track record? How can I get a track record if I can't raise any money? I'm stuck. And my response to that is, you're thinking about it the wrong way. Oftentimes, you know, this is not like your grade 3 math test where if you look on your neighbor's paper, you're cheating. Business is a team sport. And what you want to do is align yourself with other people so that you have a bit of scale, a bit of sustainability. And yes, that means that you're going to end up having to do larger projects. But trust me, from personal experience, it's actually easier to go bigger. One of the most difficult things to do is to stay small, because you don't have the resources to do things well. And so my advice is, if you're just getting started, go work with somebody, work in their team for a period of time. It could be 6 months, could be 2 years, to really develop in the role that you want to develop. And now you can legitimately borrow some of their credibility. I mean, if I think about some of the most successful real estate investors and developers that I know, I'm thinking specifically right now of Ken McElroy, who is one of Robert Kiyosaki's rich dad advisors. I spent the last week with, the first week of April with Ken on the Investor Summit at Sea. You know, Ken has 10,000 units in his portfolio. He started out as a property manager, as an employee. And it was in that time period, as an employee, as a property manager, that he really developed the skills. Today, he's got a portfolio in the hundreds of millions of dollars. He's relying on the foundation that was set during those early years. So just get a track record. If you don't have one, go get one.
So relationships, trust, results, what comes next?
Next is, you've got to have a compelling opportunity. And this is a little bit like saying beauty is in the eye of the beholder. But the number of times I've heard someone say, I had a great deal, but I just couldn't get it funded. Well, there's a clue in that. In my experience, as long as the other things are in place, and as long as you're not looking for money in the wrong place, all good deals get funded. They all get done. The only question is, who's going to do it? Is it going to be you? Is it going to be me? Or is it going to be the next guy? But all good deals get done. So if you're having a hard time attracting the money, it means you're either going about it the wrong way, or the opportunity may not be quite as compelling as you think it is. Some people, you know, are going after opportunities where their, you know, potential is maybe 10 to 15% rate of return, and that may not be compelling enough for some investors. For me, you know, the types of projects that we work on, we focus on creating a tremendous amount of value at the inception of the project. And that creates an awful lot of safety. The reason is, we're not relying on market appreciation. So if I'm built, you know, today, it's an absolute feeding frenzy out there whenever there is a multi-unit complex coming up for sale. I mean, we placed an offer a couple of weeks ago on a project in Louisiana, and there were 11 offers on the property. We placed another offer last year on a 496-unit complex in Tyler, Texas. There were 20 offers. I never want to be the winning bidder out of 20 offers, because I probably don't know something that the other 19 don't. So it's a bit of a feeding frenzy out there. So what we focus on instead is new construction. We focus on opportunities where we are building product for a third less than what it costs to buy that same product in the marketplace. And that 30% difference really translates into, I'll call it a profit margin of sorts, because I'll give you a simple example. Let's say I built a new building, and it's going to be valued at $1 million. I want to cap my investment at $700,000 so that I can then go back to the bank after it's leased up and stabilized and refinance the property at 70% loan to value, recoup 100% of my invested capital, and now I'm holding essentially a no money down deal, that's generating positive cash flow, and I have that 30% equity, but no cash tied up in it. Does that sound like a compelling opportunity? It does to me. And so it makes for a very easy conversation with investors when you're presenting opportunities of that type, where you say to them, you know, we'll return your capital in, you know, 18 to 24 months, and our exit is a refinance, and you're going to retain a share ownership of the property, and you're going to continue to get cash flow and ownership in perpetuity for as long as we hold the property, and you get your money back in the relatively short time period. That's pretty compelling.
Tell me again how you're finding or creating these opportunities.
Well, what we do, and by the way, every city in North America has this situation. If you think about the downtown core of most major cities, you know, prices are high, there's a lot of demand, and immediately outside the downtown core, there's this band of property that's been neglected for 30 years. Every city has one. You know, in Houston, it was the Heights District. In Austin, it was east of I-35. I can go down the list. Any city has that situation. And what we do is we find that dividing line and right between that hot neighborhood and the so-so neighborhood. And we buy just on the wrong side of that line. And we're able to buy property typically at a deep discount to the expensive neighborhood. Now, if we redevelop that property with new product, we can usually move the line. So now the line is on the other side of my property, and I can do it again and again and again. Now, you got to put a little bit of scale behind it. But we call this strategy buy on the line, move the line. And, you know, when you do that, you're buying land at a deep discount, you're building at the cost, whatever the cost of construction is, but you're getting the appraised value of the expensive neighborhood next door. And that's what gives you the value creation. So, for example, in Philadelphia right now, we're building in an area that is one block north of the Fairmount District. The Fairmount is an expensive area where rents for a two-bedroom might be around $1,600 a month. Are people willing to live one block away and maybe rent for $1,400 a month? The answer is yes, they are. And so we're able to get valuations that are approaching Fairmount valuations, even though we're actually a block outside the Fairmount district. That's the strategy. It's very simple.
I love that strategy. That's great. Moving on, so that's compelling opportunity. We've got relationship, trust, results, compelling opportunity. What is the fifth fundamental element to raising money?
The last element, I call it alignment, and it's a basket of other criteria. And these are more technical criteria, like what's the size of the investment? What's the term of the investment, meaning how long is the money going to be tied up for? What's the rate of return? What's the tax consequence? What's the risk? What's the security? And risk and security are a little bit different. The risk is what's the likelihood of something going bad. The security is how am I secured as an investor? Maybe I'm in first lien position. For example, if I'm a lender and I'm a 10% loan to value, I'm very secure because even if it goes bad, I'm pretty sure I'm going to get my money back. So I'm maybe less concerned about the risk. I'm focused on the security. If on the other hand, I'm at 90% loan to value, then I'm much less secure and therefore going to be much more concerned with the risk. So risk and security together define safety. They may be concerned with the control structure. And things like that. So that basket of more technical criteria I call alignment. And you need a pretty near perfect fit on those, especially if you're dealing with more sophisticated investors. They're going to be much more specific on what their investment criteria are. For example, I have, you know, one investor that I'm talking with where their investment minimum is $5 million. If my project is too small, it's not even open for consideration, even though it may meet all of the other criteria. So the more sophisticated the investor, the more clear they're going to be on what their criteria are.
Let's talk about the art of the pitch.
Sure.
Now, you've pitched venture capitalists, private equity firms, and corporate boards, as well as private investors. What elements are necessary for a successful pitch?
It really starts with the team. You really have to, because at the end of the day, they're not buying the property, they're buying you. And that means they need to have an awful lot of confidence that no matter what gets thrown at you, you have the skills and the resourcefulness, and possibly the resources as well, to figure it out. For example, I have a situation right now on a property in Philadelphia. This is a land assembly that we completed over a fairly lengthy time period, and we have zoning approval for two buildings on the property, but it doesn't encompass all of the land. And last week, the city of Philadelphia changed the zoning on the entire area, so it's now zoned single family. Now, I have two zoning approvals for two buildings, but that kind of leaves me stuck on the rest of the land. So these are the types of things that can happen, where things can change, and they're completely out of your control, they're out of my control. Are you working with the right team who has the resourcefulness to figure it out? Are they going to fold up shop and just say, sorry, we lost your money? Are they going to appeal? How's it going to get handled? So it's really knowing that the team has enough grit, persistence, sophistication to weather through whatever may be thrown at them. I think that's really where it starts. Because everybody knows, any sophisticated investor knows that whatever is written on the pro forma is not going to be the way the future unfolds. They can't tell you how it's going to be different, but they know it'll be different. So that's really the most important part of the pitch, is really gaining confidence of your investors with your team. That's where I would start.
What you're saying is that the investors are really looking at you and investing in you before they're investing in the actual opportunity.
Exactly. And I'd say if there was one rookie mistake that I see over and over and over again, it's people think it's all about the deal. And, you know, they say, well, I've got a great deal. I've got a great deal. Well, you know what? It's never about the deal. It's never about the deal.
When you talk about the art of the pitch, you talk about what is necessary for a successful pitch, but you also talk about what is not necessary. Do you know what I'm getting at, the business plan?
Absolutely. You know, often I've raised money. You know, the people who graduate from business school, they get often trained on how to put together these really elaborate business plan documents, and it's really not necessary yet. You know, I, for example, have raised money for startup companies with a PowerPoint presentation, with a 14-slide PowerPoint presentation, with no formal business plan document behind it. And now, elements of the business plan document are useful to construct so that you have that clarity of thinking. So you've gone through the thought process, and it's useful to that extent, but it's not something you would ever present to an investor. It's way too much paper, and it doesn't really address many of the questions that they're going to have, because they are going to want to know how you're going to adapt to their questions. You know, investors always have things that they're sensitive to, and those are usually driven by what they've been burned with in the past. So you may have one investor who's going to be concerned with, for example, making sure that there's no mechanics liens on a property. And, you know, he may hammer you on that. And you may not have addressed that in your business plan. So every investor is going to have their one or two things that they care deeply about, because that's been a pain point for them in the past. Really just put together a solid presentation. Don't make it too polished. I tend to make my investor conversations more conversational. And, you know, relationship is at the root of that. You know, if I have someone with whom I have a deep relationship, I'm not going to stand at the front of the room and make a formal presentation. It doesn't make any sense. We make much more sense over a coffee to be showing them very organically. Well, here are photographs of the site. You know, here's what we're planning to do. You know, maybe show them some drawings, some draft drawings from an urban planner, or maybe from an architect. Here's, you know, some of the concepts that we're working with, and then show them much more organically some of the data. It really instills a lot more confidence than giving someone a polished presentation.
So, Victor, how can someone get started in raising money? If they know how to invest in real estate, they've been using their own money, but now they realize to go bigger, they're going to need to raise other people's money. Where do they go to learn? How do they get started?
Well, I think the first thing I would do, and not to plug my book, but maybe start with reading my book. But beyond that, in order to accomplish anything successfully in life, it's not just the knowledge that you require. And if you think about, I'll use a sports analogy. Why is it that Olympic athletes hang out and train with other Olympic athletes? It's because it's only in that environment that they actually excel, is by playing with people that are either at the same level or higher. So you always want to get in an environment where you're not the smartest person in the room, where you're learning from other people that are actively doing what you want to do and doing it successfully. So, that's the reason why, when I get up in the morning, I have a spin bike in my basement. I can get on my spin bike and I can exercise at home, but I drive 15 minutes to the gym and I get in a room with 35 spin bikes and an instructor at the front. And it's not because the instructor is telling me how to operate the bike. I just get a better workout by being in that environment. And so, likewise when it comes to raising capital, who do I hang out with? I hang out with other developers and other syndicators who are raising large sums of money, and I learn from them, and they learn from me, and we feed each other. It's an amazing thing when you're in that environment, because that environment spills knowledge, it spills opportunity, it spills insight, it spills encouragement, motivation. All of those things are products of being in that environment. So that would be my number one advice. Get in an environment where other people are doing it and doing it well, and you will learn through osmosis. There are a few formal courses out there. There's not many people teaching it. The real estate guys have their syndication summit. I put on a raising capital workshop a couple of times a year. There's not a lot of people teaching it. But even after you have that, even after you have the knowledge, you've got to immerse yourself in the environment.
Yeah, it's important to push yourself outside of your comfort zone. And speaking of which, in your book, you talk about pitching a product on a TV show called Dragon's Den.
Yes.
Which is basically, it's the Canadian equivalent of Shark Tank. Can you tell us the story of what you were pitching and how that turned out?
Sure. So a friend of mine was developing a product. So let me back up. As a self-employed person, if you want to deduct your automotive expense on your taxes, you have to keep a mileage log indicating what mileage was for business use and what mileage was for personal use. And it's a cumbersome thing to do. And every time, that's one of those things that's very easy to get audited on because the IRS or, the Canadian Revenue Agency, they just need to ask for you to produce the log. And it take hours and hours of work for you to produce that. So oftentimes you end up losing a lot of money because that's not done correctly. So we developed a product that would take the odometer, would connect to the odometer. Every car has a port, a data port, that is industry standard, and we would plug a little device in there that would essentially be a Bluetooth transmitter, connect to an app on your phone, whether it was an iPhone or Android, and by communicating with the app on your phone, every time you get in the car, it would prompt you, is this a business trip or a personal trip? And you would simply click on either the blue or the red button, and it would do the rest. And then it would upload the data to either QuickBooks or an Excel spreadsheet, whatever you want. So that was the application. And we decided to go on Dragon's Den. Dragon's Den actually preceded Shark Tank by, I think, about 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, and didn't some of the sharks actually come from Dragon's Den?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. Kevin was from Dragon's Den, Robert Herkovic as well. They started there. Correct. So So we went on the show. I went on the show. I pitched the idea. It was a great experience. Not unlike the kind of pitches that I've done in the venture capital community many times in my career. Now, we did not get funded. In particular, what the Dragons were looking for was they wanted they were not ready to invest in something that was this early stage. We were still pre-revenue, and they wanted to see sales as a launch pad rather than a concept and a proof of concept. They wanted to see active sales. So none of the Dragons were willing to fund it on that basis. But they liked the idea. And in the end, they were right. We found what we discovered is that there were so many permutations and combinations of what I'll call non-industry standard customizations of that OBD data port that we, every time a new vehicle came out, we would have to retest. We would have to retest the application. And when you do the math on the number of permutations and combinations of vehicle models and operating system versions for the various smartphone platforms, that test matrix just exploded in size and complexity to the point where down the road we would be expending a tremendous amount of effort simply keeping the application running without really the promise of any new revenue. So the business model, while it would be successful in the short term, we concluded that it would break in the long term because we'd spend too much engineering effort just keeping the application running. So we abandoned the project in the end.
Wow. From a pitching perspective, how nerve-wracking was that to be up there in front of the Dragons in the Dragon Den?
It was a neat experience because you're doing it on set with cameras rolling, and it's really just like they show it on television. It's exactly like they show it on TV. Sometimes they'll, you know, edit down. If it's 45 minutes, they'll edit it down to 10 minutes. But it was really not unlike many of the conversations I'd had over the years raising venture capital, where, you know, I'd be in a boardroom full of folks, and they're throwing questions at me, and I'm either answering them well or not and learning from the experience. It was very much like that. And I think Dragon's Den, Shark Tank are great shows for any budding entrepreneur to really study as a way of, you know, what are investors looking for? I think it's a great show because it actually mirrors what happens in real life.
In the process of pitching, and it sounds like you've done it quite a bit, have you ever experienced a complete fail, like where everything just went wrong?
Oh, sure.
And absolutely. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, so, this is a great example. So back in 2004, I put together a startup company specifically to go acquire IBM's microprocessor division, and we were looking to raise about $250 million. And I started talking to venture capital firms, and these firms had a track record of, you know, making investments of maybe $10 million, $15 million, maybe $20 million at a time. And after a few weeks of this, you know, getting kicked out one after another, I came to the conclusion, number one, I was looking in the wrong place because it was just not the type of thing that they would do. And number two, if I had to put together, a soup full of 8 or 10 different venture capital firms, I would never get there because they would never see eye to eye on how this thing should be run, because each of them would want to have too much of a say in the future direction. So I was really going about it all the wrong way. But in the process of making those pitches and failing, I actually got quite a bit better at delivering a solid pitch. So when we finally did get in front of the right audience, so in the end, we ended up working with some private equity firms. And, you know, these are companies like Bain Capital and Texas Pacific Group and Francisco Partners, folks that literally have billions in their war chest. They do much bigger deals, and they were able to give us feedback literally right in the meeting. Yes, they're interested. No, they're not. And, you know, we did 12 pitches in 2 days to private equity firms, and we got 4 people to say yes over a 48-hour period. So we were looking in the wrong place to begin with, but it was a very valuable process to go through that failure, because it really set us up for doing a much stronger pitch when it came to the right people.
You have a chapter in your book titled, your book, by the way, is Magnetic Capital. You have a chapter titled, Investors Are a Fickle Bunch.
And yes, they are.
So why would you say that?
Life happens. And, you know, if you're an entrepreneur and you've got a project that you're trying to execute, you're running a business, and that capital is needed for that business to run successfully. So, it's a little bit like, I'll call it a little bit like herding cats, where, you know, often investors say, yes, I'm interested, or they make a commitment, but it's the firmness of that commitment is clear in your mind, but may not be as clear in their mind. So, if your capital raise takes too long, maybe it takes 90 days, maybe it takes 120 days, and you haven't talked to them in 2-3 weeks, they may have found another use for the money and not told you. And you come back and you say, okay, we're ready to go. And they say, oh, well, we'll catch you on the next project. So it's very important to stay connected with your investors through the capital raise process, make sure they're on board, and really gauge the firmness of their commitment. So what that often translates into is making sure that your capital raise is oversubscribed, so that if somebody does drop out for whatever reason, you're still covered. It's a little bit like overbooking in the airlines, and I know there's a lot of strong emotions around that, especially in the news these days, about whether that's a good practice or not. But overbooking, on average, overbooking has turned out to be the right decision for the airlines. Otherwise, they wouldn't be doing it.
Luckily, when it comes to these kinds of deals, you don't actually have to physically drag your investors out of a deal.
Exactly.
You're also in a mastermind group with George Ross, who is one of Donald Trump's associates and mentors, and people might remember him from The Apprentice. What's
yes.
that like to be? What kind of mastermind group is that, and what's it like to be amongst people like George Ross?
George is amazing. You're right. He was on The Apprentice for, I think, about 10 seasons. He's masterful. And I would say he's the guy that I would credit ultimately with the success of the Trump Organization. Obviously, many people had a role to play, but George really is that guy. He did the very first deal with Donald when Donald was 27 years old, and he was worked for him for most of the past 40 years up until the time that Donald announced his bid for the White House. George is, but before George worked for Donald, he worked for a gentleman named Saul Goldman, and he took Saul Goldman from 18 properties to 720 over a 10-year period, and he wrote every single one of those deals personally. So there's nothing like that kind of practice and repetition to really hone your skills. And this man has seen it all. I mean, he's 89 years old. The depth of his wisdom astounds me every time I talk to him. We have a monthly mastermind where a bunch of us get together on the phone every month, and we hit George with questions. Now, I chair the call. I curate the questions, and usually in an hour we'll get through a dozen, maybe 14 questions. George receives them a day or two in advance, so he has time to research them. And he comes out with the most amazing wisdom, often counterintuitive, often the opposite of what I think the right answer is. And when he explains his rationale, my goodness, he's right. And so I just value him for his wisdom, for his generosity in sharing. It is a paid mastermind. There is a monthly fee to participate. He insists on that because he doesn't want people, often when you get stuff for free, people don't value it. I'm so grateful and so fortunate. And at 89 years of age, I would say he's still at the top of his game. It's amazing.
That sounds like a great group to be a part of. As we wrap it up, Victor, is there any parting thoughts or advice you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Don't be scared of raising money. Just make sure that you're doing it well. If you want to find out more about it, you know, there are resources out there. My book is one of them. If you want to order the book, you can get it at victorjm.com. We'll be launching it in the second quarter, so it's not yet on Amazon, but it will be later in the quarter. And in the meantime, you can order pre-release copies at victorjm.com. And, you know, we've got a bunch of tools and resources there to help you evaluate how you're doing in raising capital. So we have a magnetic capital scorecard that you can use to evaluate how you're doing. And then just get around people that are doing it and doing it well. That would be my advice.
So that's Victor, VictorJM, as in Mary, .com. That's where you can pick up the book. The book is called Magnetic Capital, How to Raise All the Money You Need for Any Worthy Venture. Victor Menashe, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us today, and congratulations on your book.
Thank you, Brian. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Rental Property Owner and Real Estate Investor Podcast, brought to you by the Rental Property Owner Association. You can find out more at rpoaonline.org. If you enjoyed this podcast, please go to iTunes to subscribe, rate, and review.